Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll talk to AFGE 14th District National Vice President Dwight Bowman about unity within the labor movement, Field Services and Education Director Bill Fletcher about the AFL-CIO's Solidarity Center trip to North Africa, and Legislative Representative John Threlkeld about the union's efforts to curtail privatization efforts in the federal government. Up first, AFGE 14th District National Vice President Dwight Bowman. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
NVP Bowman, this year we've seen an unprecedented attack on public workers throughout all levels of government, starting really with initiatives by legislators in Ohio and Wisconsin. Share your thoughts on that situation.
Well, this was something that we all knew was coming. We simply didn't know how devastating it would be, how mean and angry the opposition would be. But for years, we have seen certain legislators attempting to change the dynamic between the middle class and the rest of the country.
This also provided an opportunity for working people, labor unions to come together and stand together in the face of these attacks. How do you assess the response by the working people in this situation?
When you look at how Wisconsin in particular has responded, it has been magnificent. I think that what happened in Wisconsin, even though it was mimicked in Ohio in the same way and worse ways, and also in Florida and other parts of the country, I think that the coverage by the media of Wisconsin was very dynamic, and it drew everyone in. When you have the television cameras there showing what's going on, and you have commenters talking about the details of how, in this particular case, a Republican governor was attacking the labor movement and the foundation of what labor believes is right, it was just overwhelming. Now, the labor movement has come together over that particular event. What we saw was all of the unions saying, let me send someone there, let me send some money, let me help by writing my congressman and having my members to provide support. So that was excellent. But we need to do more. It needs to be continuing. We need to look at every state in the union. When you look at the map and you see how these right-to-work ideas are manifesting themselves across the country, there's no doubt that the labor movement has to work faster, harder, smarter, and more in unity.
NVP Bowman, as someone who has been a part of the labor movement for quite some time, a labor leader, what goes through your mind when you hear of stories about legislators trying to take away the rights of public employees?
Well, it's really the greed factor. Ever since the Second World War, we see the rise of union power. But at the same time, we also saw, for lack of a better term, the right wing, those who are greedy in the right wing, attempting to change that dynamic and to lessen the union power. Many people will remember the slogan that we had a number of union slogans out there, look for the union label and such as that. And we had a good handle on how profits were divided up in the country. And I believe back in those days we had something like CEOs making 30 times more than the average worker in whatever company. Now we have the dynamic of CEOs making 500 times and more than what the average worker in the company makes. But we do not see that money necessarily being reinvested in the company so that the company can prosper, can grow, can hire more people, can produce better products. That is just something that is not happening. With the public sector in particular, we also recognize that there is that those same individuals, that same thinking is manifested in individuals saying, well, there's too much government regulation. We don't need any regulation. We can regulate ourselves. And this is all about being able to do what they want to do without being accountable. It takes us back to a society where buyer beware, where individuals are responsible for whether or not they buy a good product, that no one is held accountable for the products, where banks can charge exorbitant rates for plastic, for the credit cards that people use, for going to the ATM machines. When you don't have regulation, you don't have good air, you don't have clean water, and you don't have fresh food.
In your time in the labor movement, MVP Bowman, can you remember another time where public workers had such a target on their backs?
Not to this degree. As I point out, this is nothing new. There have always been those who would attempt to thwart regulation and would try to grow profits without sharing the profits with the workers that make the production, that protect America. That's always been. But never in the history of this country, to my knowledge, has there been this much money and this much energy poured into demonizing those who make up the middle class and those who are the defenders of this country. There's only one group that has not been demonized, and that is our soldiers overseas. They are afraid to touch that. They do not want to say, you folks aren't doing your job. What they do is they wave the flag and say that these folks are sacrificing and that they're doing the nation's work. But when those same folks come out of the military and they're the same loyal Americans, when it comes time to getting a job, whether it be the private sector or the public sector, they are then demonized when they ask for equity in terms of the benefits and wages that they receive.
And so where are you taking AFGE's 14th District forward in this fight? What are you doing in response to these attacks?
The 14th District is a reflection of America. We have all kinds of folks in the 14th District, and the most important thing that we can do, there are two things that we must do in the 14th District and that we are moving towards. One is education of the population of our members, making sure that they understand the dynamic, who's doing what, why they're doing it, and how it affects them, and what they can do to thwart that or to stop it if that be necessary. The other thing is to prepare for the worst while fighting for the best. There's a necessity for us to understand that each time a bill goes up to Congress, if certain politicians can attach something to that bill which is anti-union or anti-public employee, they make that effort. With regard to the union issue, for instance, one of the things that we see is this constant attempt to attach something dealing with official time for union representatives so that they can be denied the opportunity to represent the people that are members of AFGE and other unions as well. Well, it's necessary for us to let our folks know, well, this is what we're doing to fight that. This is what you can do to help us. And worst case scenario, this is the plan of action that we intend to implement.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with AFGE 14th District National Vice President Dwight Bowman. MVP Bowman, shifting gears for a second, the last time that we spoke, news had just broke about the D.C. budget. Where does that issue stand today?
Well, the budget is about to go to the House floor, we believe. It should be coming up on the House floor next month. We have not been hearing about more sacrifice, more layoffs or anything such as that, but that is still yet to come because we still have other budgets to come forward. District of Columbia is still in a shortfall situation. What we're doing is trying to work with the city council, the mayor, establish relationships, come up with viable solutions as to what alternatives there are to hurting the very people that we represent. One of the problems that we have is we need all of the information as to what is going on with the budget and where the cuts are being made, how that's affecting the community, so that we can formulate ideas and proposals as to what can be done in the alternative if it is something that is not agreeable to us or is harmful to those that we represent.
Is the D.C. government, does it operate the same way that the federal government does? Is it permitted to run deficits and incur debts?
No, it's not, in fact. The federal government has a lot of latitude, so to speak, compared to the District of Columbia. The District of Columbia has certain rules, regulations, laws, which say that you will work within certain boundaries. And it's also important to note that when there's a problem with D.C. or when there's any legislation involving the District of Columbia, it has to seek, the District of Columbia has to seek and receive certain approvals from the federal government. With the federal government, once a budget is passed and once it is implemented, that's the end of it. You have the arguing and the haranguing that goes on before that. But with D.C., there is the debate and discussion. There is the proposal. Then there's more debate and discussion. Then you have the vote. Then it goes up to Capitol Hill. There's more debate and discussion. And then there is either approval, no approval, or it just sits there and then passes based on time.
You had mentioned the idea of cuts from the D.C. budget, and we've obviously heard a lot about that in federal discussions as well. How do these proposed cuts, particularly in the D.C. budget, affect the community and the people who rely on those public services?
Well, that can be devastating when you're looking at a city-state such as the District of Columbia. Anytime you're making cuts across the board or in specific areas, wherever that specific area is going to be less than, the services are going to be less than, and when it's across the board, then everything is a little bit less than. And I think all of us know from personal experience that when you cut just a little across the board, you can use different methods to make up for those cuts. But when the cuts are very severe, very deep in particular areas, then it can be devastating to a community. You can have libraries closing. You can have more youth offenders on the street. You can have less services for those who are in need of mental health care. We can see the problems mounting across the city, and the deeper the cuts are, the longer they last, the more intrusive they are, the greater and more severity the pain of those who need those services.
What's been the response of D.C. residents about the budget?
The D.C. residents are really pinning their hopes on their city council people and their new mayor to provide them with the best possible alternatives. Now, many of the groups are having as much input as they can with regard to their specific items, the things that affect them most. But how much impact any of us are having at this point in time is yet to be seen.
You had mentioned city council, and recently there was a shuffle in some of the assignments for council members. What's your response to that?
Well, I'm a little bit disappointed in that we were not expecting these shuffles. I'm not sure as to why these changes were made. I'm not sure of the basis for believing that this is going to make the city council better. I do believe in occasionally making changes, but this is so widespread that it's a little befuddling to me. As far as District 14 is concerned, and I think the other labor unions, we establish relationships with the city councilmen and their and the city council persons and their staff, and we attempt to provide them with information that they don't otherwise have. And that means that we now have to enter a new education process, a new learning process, a new process of getting to know folks.
What prompted the change in assignments?
I'm not sure. Honestly, there are probably a couple of different ideas out there, but generally speaking, and this is just my theory about many changes that go on. Many changes are intended to bring about greater control. The person who is making the change often makes the change, the person or entity, is often doing so to reestablish control of a given area or areas.
MVP Bowman, one of the departments that you work very closely with in the 14th District is the Department of Youth Rehabilitation Services. What's your response to the choice of the new director for the agency?
We have been very forthright on this particular appointment and selection. We are disappointed. We are highly disappointed that no one from the administration gave us a heads up that this was the person being considered, Mr. Neil Stanley. And we're very disappointed that we didn't have an opportunity to weigh in and provide information, factual information, that we have. This is one that we openly opposed, and we did make some very, very good headway. We sent out alerts to the citizens who are members of AFGE explaining what our opposition was and why. And we got a very good response, and we were able to make some changes and some minds with regard to the city council. But there was a great deal of arm twisting that went on, and Mr. Stanley has been confirmed for that position. We will attempt to work with him, but it's no secret that we were thoroughly disappointed.
AFGE 14th District National Vice President Dwight Bowman, as always, sir, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me, and let's move forward together.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn about the AFL-CIO's Solidarity Center trip to North Africa with AFGE Field Services and Education Department Director Bill Fletcher.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. Call the AFGE Benefits line at 1-888-844-2343 today to see how much you could save. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Bill Fletcher, Director of AFGE's Field Services and Education Department. Bill, welcome back to the program.
Always glad to be here.
Bill, you recently returned from a Solidarity Center trip to North Africa. Tell us about the trip.
Well, let me first start with saying who the Solidarity Center is, because many of your listeners may be unfamiliar with them. The AFL-CIO has an arm. It's actually an independent organization. It's a nonprofit called the Solidarity Center. And they are the mechanism for the AFL-CIO, for unions in the United States, to deliver assistance to union movements around the world. And they have offices all over the world, particularly in Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. They do have some offices in Europe. And I have worked in one way or another with the Solidarity Center for years, going back to 1997, when I was at the AFL-CIO as the director of education and traveled to Brazil. And I did a couple of trips to Brazil, and then I started going to Southern Africa in 1999, many times. And this was my first trip to North Africa and the Middle East. And so the objective of this trip was to bring a delegation to North Africa and Palestine to get a clearer picture of the situation facing unions and the situation facing the people there, particularly in this time of turbulence, as you know, with the so-called Arab Spring or the Arab Democratic Revolution. We were also looking to try to establish how unions in the United States could work with the unions and union movements in North Africa and Palestine. So we had a delegation that included me, representing AFGE, Mark Gaffney, who is the president of the Michigan AFL-CIO, Shannon Lederer from the American Federation of Teachers, and Shauna Bader Blau from the Solidarity Center, who was coordinating and leading the trip. When we were in Palestine, we were joined by Arlene Holt Baker, who is the executive vice president of the AFL-CIO. And she was only there for the Palestine part of the trip. And after that, she went on to visit Israel.
This must have been a fascinating time to visit that region. How did the Democratic Revolution play into your trip and some of the experiences that you had?
Well, this was fascinating. I mean, this is one of these life-altering trips. This is, I think, my third life-altering trip. My first was to Northern Ireland in 1988, not for the Solidarity Center. My second was to South Africa, beginning in 1999, and this is the third. How to answer your question? You know, it's interesting, Jason. This trip, in one respect or another, had been in the works for a couple of years, so it preceded the revolution. There are unions and union movements that are partners of the Solidarity Center and the AFL-CIO in the Arab world that have needed assistance. And the assistance can be any number of things, but it also might simply be that they're isolated and they want people to know about their struggles, for example, in Algeria. So we had been talking about this trip for a few years, and then it was expanded after a meeting with a delegation from the Palestine General Federation of Trade Unions back in February 2010. The PGFTU really wanted a delegation, and preferably a higher level delegation, to visit Palestine to see the conditions that exists with the occupation, to talk with people, to understand some of the worker issues, as well as the broader political issues. So it expanded. And we were originally supposed to, when it became a Palestine-Algeria Egypt trip, we were supposed to go in February. But then the revolutions broke out, and it became a bit risky to go. So we pushed it off. We were supposed to go again to Algeria, and unfortunately, the Algerian government, for reasons that we don't understand, did not provide us with a visa. So instead, we ended up going to Tunisia, which was fine. And what ended up happening was that some Algerian trade unionists that we were supposed to meet with came to visit with us in Tunisia. So we went to Tunisia, then we flew to Amman, Jordan, and took a shuttle over to the border and crossed the border into occupied Palestine, and then spent a couple of days there, then returned to Amman and flew to Cairo.
What was the emotional state of the people that you interacted with? What was the feeling that you got during the trip?
You were in a revolution. I've never been in a revolution before. I've been, the closest I'd say is the feeling I had when I was in Venezuela back in 2004, where there was a lot of excitement, a lot of people looking to influence change. That's how it felt from the very beginning with Tunisia. On the one hand, you saw things like troops on the streets, but you didn't feel intimidated by the troops because the dictator was gone. You felt like people were asking a lot of questions. They wanted to be involved in the change. The union movement, Jason, the union movement there is growing. I mean, you have workers joining unions. One of the problems that we were told about was they said, you know, Bill, you know, we have all these professionals that want to join us and we don't know what to do. And I started laughing and I said, my God, I wish I had that problem, you know. They are outgrowing their organizational capacity. The union movement in Tunisia is led by a federation. It's sort of their AFL-CIO. It's called the UGTT, which translated in English is the General Union of Tunisian Workers. And what happened is that when the revolution started to unfold in Tunisia, leaders at the kind of intermediate level emerged and pushed the organization to play a major role. And in fact, they became one of the leading forces in the Tunisian revolution. So when we met with the general secretary, he was saying, well, one of the things we have to do is make sure we succeed in winning democracy, and we have to root out the dictatorship.
In terms of the union movement in Tunisia, what's the biggest challenge facing the workers as they strive to organize a union?
Ooh. Well, there's several. One is capacity. That is that they need to increase the resources that are available. They need to do a lot more training of activists and leaders to address what they're facing. So that's one very big challenge. A second challenge is political. There are upcoming elections, popular elections in Tunisia. And there are forces that are running that are very backward, that want to derail the Tunisian revolution. That's a second challenge. A third challenge is that there are forces, and this is also true in Egypt, there are forces from the West, the Western countries, particularly Europe and U.S. and Canada, that are attempting to influence the Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions in a way that makes them actually less revolutionary and more open to a pro-corporate orientation. And so the Tunisians are trying to figure out, and the Egyptians are trying to figure out what to do about that. But those are three of the major challenges. There are other challenges that are linked. I mean, for example, when we were in Tunisia, we met with a lot of women activists from within the union movement who are really gutsy and very exciting, and they are looking for a greater role for women in the leadership of the union movement and in the country as a whole. And they don't want to be sent back to the kitchens. So, you know, that's another challenge.
And how are they going about pushing these women to the top to ensure that there's more equality among all people?
They have a Congress coming up in December. And after that, we can have another discussion to see whether they're successful. But it's building towards the Congress. And, you know, resolutions, including about the percentage of women in leadership that will be addressed. So that's where we are now. Whether they're successful, we won't know until December.
Are there fears of returning to the days of dictatorship? Fears of extremists trying to derail their plans of organizing?
There's less fears of returning to a dictatorship than there are fears that conservative Islamist forces, and I emphasize conservative Islamists, not making some blanket statement, may succeed both in Tunisia and Egypt in derailing things and pushing things back, particularly about the question of women. But not just, because many of these Islamist forces in both Tunisia and Egypt are not really interested in unions. And so they are actually, in many ways, pro-corporate, even when they are critical of Western capitalism.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue with AFGE Field Services and Education Department Director Bill Fletcher.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with AFGE Field Services and Education Department Director Bill Fletcher, who recently returned from an AFL-CIO Solidarity Center trip to North Africa. Bill, before the break, we discussed Tunisia, but let's now move on to Egypt and the role labor unions play there.
Well, it's very different in Egypt because in Egypt, the official labor movement, which is represented by something called the Egyptian Trade Union Federation, was pro-Mubarak. They were pro-regime. And so when the revolution is unfolding, instead of them playing the role that the General Union of Tunisian Workers played, they instead were encouraging repression of the people. There was, however, or is, a separate independent movement of unions that has been growing. And these forces were very involved in the revolution. And in fact, in the final days, one of the things that everyone is convinced that forced Mubarak out were strikes, waves of strikes that these independent unions began to call. So we met with the independents, many of them, with their leadership body, and they're in the process of forming a new federation. And we also met with individuals, workers, from some in a place called Sadat City. And it was very interesting. I mean, it was a dialogue. They were asking us questions, and we were asking them questions, but they were asking us about things like what to do when you can't strike. And I said, well, we have that problem. I said, in the United States, we formally or technically have the right to strike, but the way that the laws are implemented and permanent replacement, effectively, we can't strike. So I talked with them about other tactics that can be used. They described some of the conditions that they're facing. They also described the political situation and the upcoming elections and the forces that they want to see engaged. So again, there was this vibrancy, there was excitement.
It sounds like you found a common point with some of the unions in Egypt.
Many common points.
What else did you see?
Well, not just in Egypt. In both in Egypt and Tunisia, we met with public sector workers. And public sector workers, wherever you go, are facing same kind of problems. Privatization, subcontracting, being demonized as being some labor aristocracy, everywhere. We met in Egypt with some teachers. And I mentioned that one of our delegation was from the AFT. And it was remarkable. It felt like it was old home week. You know, same kind of issues. The vouchers, the issue of non-teachers, non-educators designing education. Similar kinds of problems that we face.
As we bring this full circle, Bill, how do workers from around the globe, especially public workers who remain under attack. How do we fight back against that?
Well, one of the things is that it's important for us to understand, whether we're in the United States or Egypt, to understand that as public sector workers, the attacks that we're facing are not unique to us. That it's part of a larger problem that we're facing. And that there are economic forces involved, individuals, elites, that are attempting to roll back the clock, that are challenging the basic notion of public service, and are attempting to pirate the public service, public sector, in order to gain profits for individual companies and privateers. So I think that's important. It's important to start thinking about ways that we can collaborate in challenging certain kinds of subcontractors. You have certain multinational firms that are engaged in subcontracting here and in North Africa. So there may be ways of sharing research.
Do you see the labor movement in the Middle East and North Africa as a tool to help further the democratic revolution and bring people's standard of living up to a higher place?
Not only that, I see the Arab Spring as inspiring us. I mean, let's be clear. Had there not been the Arab Democratic Revolution, there would have been no Madison, Wisconsin. The demonstrations that took place in Wisconsin were directly inspired by the people of Tunisia, the people of Egypt, the people of Yemen, the people of Jordan, that started despite conditions that are far worse than anything that we've experienced, that had the courage to stand up. And this resonated. People in Wisconsin knew something is different here. People in Ohio started to feel something is different. What we have to do, though, in learning from the experiences there, is that it's not a one-shot deal. If you're going to pursue the forces of greed and avarice, it's not about just one grand demonstration, Jason. It's about be there as long as it takes.
Is this an opportunity, in your mind, for international unions from North Africa and the Middle East to work more closely with those in the U.S.?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I suggested to the Tunisians is that we need to send delegations of U.S. trade unionists to Tunisia to learn from them. You know, we in the United States often think that we're the sources of all light and life, you know. But here you found that there's so much to learn from other people's experiences. I think that we'd learn an immense amount about a new approach to trade unionism were we to send delegations there.
Bill Fletcher, Director of AFGE's Field Services and Education Department. Bill, as always, thank you for your time.
My pleasure, Jason. Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll hear from AFGE Legislative Representative John Threlkeld on the union's efforts to curtail contracting out in the federal government.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by John Threlkeld, AFGE Legislative Representative. John, welcome back to Inside Government.
Thanks for having me.
John, for years, AFGE has been fighting to stop contracting in the federal government, particularly in the Department of Defense. Where does this issue stand today?
Well, I'd have to say that federal employees are being targeted across in all agencies as a result of amendments offered by House Republicans to various appropriation bills that have been considered thus far. We achieved or got enacted into law several prohibitions against using the OMB Circular 876 privatization process in various appropriations bills. For example, in the Homeland Security Appropriation Bill, there is a longstanding provision to prevent the 876 process from being used to privatize jobs performed by federal employees who investigate and adjudicate citizenship rights and benefits. That one was struck as a result of a floor amendment to the House Homeland Security Appropriations Bill. We have had a provision since, I think, 2008 to prevent the 876 process from being used to privatize any Corps of Engineers employees. That provision was struck as a result of a floor amendment to the Energy and Water Appropriations Bill. The Defense Appropriations Bill has had a provision since FY10, which says that DOD can't start any new A-76 studies or continue with ongoing A-76 studies until it has finally completed an inventory of service contractors and integrated the results into the budget process, and has come up with a plan for addressing problems in the A-76 process that have been identified by the DOD Inspector General and the Government Accountability Office. That provision was struck as a result of a floor amendment. We are gaining about 16 to 19 Republicans on each of these votes and losing 1 to 2 Democrats, but it's, you know, the majority's margin is so big that we just don't have any hope, really, of beating back these amendments. The next fight coming up, which might be of interest to your members, affects federal employees in all agencies. The Financial Services Appropriations Bill has included since FY09 a provision which prevents any agency from starting a new A-76 study. We expect Representative Pete Sessions, a Republican from Texas, who has offered the amendments I mentioned earlier, to offer an amendment to strike the anti-A-76 provision in the Financial Services Appropriations Bill. That bill would have been on the floor this week had there not been an unrelated jurisdictional dispute between the Ways and Means Committee and the Appropriations Committee. And so that bill did not go to the floor this week as had been anticipated. So AFG activists who would like to weigh in with their lawmakers and urge them to oppose a Sessions amendment to strike Section 733, which includes the prohibition against new A-76 studies in all federal agencies, have even more time to do so. I should say that, you know, AFG is preparing to fight to defend these provisions in conference. You know, as your listeners know, you know, the House passes their bill, their version of an appropriations bill. The Senate passes their version of the appropriations bill. And then the two versions are reconciled in conference. And we're going to work hard to ensure that Senate versions of these bills, where, you know, the Senate does still have a Democratic majority, these bills do not include or still include the safeguards against using A-76 and that the Senate's position prevail in conference. So we have a lot of work ahead, but, you know, we've lost some battles in the House, but the outcome of the wars remains to be seen. I should also say that there was an amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill to eliminate the requirement that DOD at least conduct cost comparisons before taking our work and giving them to contractors. You know, it seems fairly obvious. You know, people can disagree or agree about you know, whether or not we should have an OMB Circular 876 privatization process. But I sort of thought everybody agreed that there ought to be cost comparisons before DOD would take work away from federal employees and give them to contractors to determine if taxpayers' interests would be well served. That provision has been in the Defense Appropriations Bill since FY04. It was actually put into law when Republicans controlled the House, the Senate, and the administration. So that gives you an idea as to just how radical an approach some members of the House are taking with respect to, you know, federal employees' jobs. We still have another statutory requirement that DOD conduct cost comparisons before converting work performed by DOD civilian employees to contractor performance in Title 10. So if this provision were eliminated, you know, we'd still have that additional law to fall back on. But, you know, there's no question if they're successful in striking this law, they're going to go after, you know, the other statutory safeguard as well. So, you know, they talk a lot about, you know, promoting competition, but they're not interested in fixing the A76 process. You know, as you probably know, GAO and the IG have said repeatedly that the A76 process doesn't track costs and savings, that the costs of doing the process of conducting A76 studies are ignored, and that the A76 process includes a significant bias against federal employees because it overcharges them for overhead costs. So, you know, for now, a solid majority of House Republicans are promoting the A76 process, even though independent third parties have determined that it doesn't work. And some House Republicans are also interested in stripping away even the ability of federal employees to compete in defense of their jobs before their work is contracted out.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with AFGE Legislative Representative John Threlkeld. John, we knew from the 8 years in the Bush administration that privatization and contracting out were a priority. However, with the election of Barack Obama, who became president, one of his initiatives was to bring that work back into the federal government where it could be done by federal employees. Have agencies followed suit? It sounds a little bit like you're saying they haven't all followed suit. What's the disconnect there?
I'd say that agencies have made slow progress on complying with the law regarding insourcing. In FY08, during the latter part of the Bush administration, DOD was required to develop a policy whereby they would give special consideration to insourcing certain functions, work that would have been contracted out without competition, the presumption being it costs more than it should, work contracted out that's poorly performed and might be better performed by reliable and experienced federal employees, and then work that was contracted out but is actually closely associated with inherently governmental functions, things like preparing budgets, developing regulations, overseeing contractors. And DOD had a fairly robust insourcing program underway. Tens of thousands of contractor jobs were slated to be brought back in-house in order to save money or to ensure public control over important or sensitive functions that never should have been outsourced in the first place. And DOD acknowledges that they saved significant sums of money. In fact, in FY10 alone, DOD reported saving almost $1 billion. Unfortunately, as a result of the efficiency initiative, which was announced in August of 2010, it became almost impossible for DOD to insource anything, even inherently governmental functions associated with acquisition. That is to say, you know, contractors making awards or overseeing contractors. The efficiency initiative caps the civilian workforce at FY10 levels, and that actually forces many agencies to reduce sometimes by tens of thousands, the number of civilian positions in order to get down to that FY10 cap. And so when there's all this pressure to drive down the size of the civilian workforce, it obviously makes it impossible to, in most cases, to insource work. You know, even if money could be saved, even if the work's inherently governmental. So there's been a dramatic drop in insourcing despite DOD's success. In the non-DOD agencies, a similar law was enacted at the beginning of the Obama administration, and there has been some progress, but mostly of inherently governmental work or closely associated with inherently governmental work, particularly in the Department of Homeland Security, which has an intelligent, robust effort underway. Unfortunately, there's been very little consideration of insourcing commercial functions. That is to say, bringing work back in-house for reasons of cost. You know, there are myriad reports from IGs and GAO about waste, fraud, and abuse in service contracting. So there's no shortage of There's no shortage of contracts that could be brought back in-house in order to save money for taxpayers. But OMB has not issued guidance to agencies that would allow them to do cost comparisons, the cost comparisons necessary to insource that work. So there's been very little insourcing of commercial functions which is pretty odd considering, we're in a time of, very conscious about, spending and the need to reduce spending. One would think that, the hundreds of billions of dollars that are spent annually on service contracts would receive, particular attention, and that we'd consider the option of bringing some of that work back in-house so it could be performed by federal employees at a reduced cost to taxpayers.
John, you had previously mentioned, obviously, attempts here to drive down the civilian workforce, not allowing federal employees to compete for their own jobs. What did these initiatives do to the morale of the workers in these agencies?
I think it's crushing because, I think they had hopes that DOD was going to move from their traditional approach of favoring contractors at the expense of federal employees, the same policies that had been pursued by the Department of Defense so ruinously during the Clinton and Bush years. And it was a false hope or a hope that was not realized, because at the same time the civilian workforce is being driven down, the FY12 budget request from DOD would significantly increase spending on service contracts. We note with approval that the Senate Armed Services Committee in their mark for the FY12 Defense Authorization Bill would cap service contracting costs at the FY10 level, so at least there would be comparability between civilian employees and contractors, because it obviously makes no sense to cap one part of the workforce while allowing the other part of the workforce to run rampant, because it makes it more likely that work that we perform right now will be converted to contractor performance in order for DOD to get its civilian workforce down. It also makes it impossible for us to perform new work, even if we could do it more efficiently, even if the work's inherently governmental. And as I mentioned earlier, insourcing becomes very difficult, because how can you grow the workforce to perform work more efficiently that contractors have been doing, or work that contractors have been doing that's actually inherently governmental, if you can't, if you're all under such onerous pressure to reduce the size of the civilian workforce. So it must be crushing for DOD civilian employees to know that, their work is not valued, and that DOD is approaching the management of the civilian workforce from a strictly arbitrary numerical approach of saying, well, you can only have this number of civilian employees. It doesn't matter how efficient they are. It doesn't matter how, what sort of work's involved. We're only going to have X number of civilian employees perform the work, even though there is a statutory prohibition against managing the civilian workforce by arbitrary personnel ceilings like DOD is doing now.
John, my last question for you on this is, how's AFGE going to move forward with reform initiatives and trying to get this situation reversed?
Well, I think we are involved in several defensive battles. We want to ensure that the prohibitions against using the A-76 process are maintained. So we're going to be very much involved in keeping those prohibitions in Senate versions of the appropriation bills I mentioned earlier, and then working with our friends in both the House and the Senate to ensure that the Senate's position prevails in conference and that these prohibitions are maintained. Until problems in the A-76 process have been fixed, and until all agencies have reliable and comprehensive inventories of their service contractors so that they can insource as easily as they have outsourced, so they can control contractor costs as easily as they have always controlled federal employee costs.
John Threlkeld, AFGE Legislative Representative. John, as always, thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for talking about my issues.
Thank you to our guest this week, AFGE 14th District National Vice President Dwight Bowman, Field Services and Education Department Director Bill Fletcher, and Legislative Representative John Threlkeld. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and MetLife.